Welcome to Lecture 8 of the Human Action course. Before I get to the chapter today, I wanted to go over very briefly a few points. I was looking at the quiz number 6, your responses to quiz number 6, and as usual, people did very well on the quiz, but there were a few questions that some people had trouble with that I just wanted to go over. It would show that I didn't explain the points as well as I should have. Now, there was one that I asked, what is the relation between, in praxeology, the science of human action that Mises is talking about throughout Human Action, the book Human Action, what is the relation between the concept of action and the theorems of praxeology? And what I wanted was that they form a deductive system, that we're trying to get what follows from the concept of action. This is what praxeology is. And one of the alternatives was that the concept of action causes the rest of praxeology. And that wasn't the one I wanted. Now, I was thinking perhaps the question was a bit badly worded, and sometimes we use the word cause as for the reason. We said, what is the cause of something? I mean, what is the reason for it? So maybe the people who thought that was the correct answer were thinking that the concept of action is the reason for the rest of praxeology. But usually, at least today, when we talk about a cause of something, we mean something that brings something about. Say, when I threw the hand grenade at the building, why was there an explosion? I say, throwing the hand grenade caused or brought about the explosion. So you see, in this sense of cause, the concept of action doesn't bring about the theorems of praxeology that are deduced from it. It's not a causal relation, at least if we're understanding the word cause the way it's usually used now. So see, that was, I did want to go over, praxeology is a deductive system. It isn't that the concept of action is bringing about the rest of praxeology. Our second question that a few people missed was this. Remember, I was talking about transitive preferences, and transitive preferences would be a situation like this. Suppose you prefer vanilla ice cream to chocolate ice cream, and chocolate ice cream to strawberry ice cream. So what happens if you have a choice between vanilla ice cream and strawberry ice cream? In order to be transitive, you would have to prefer vanilla to strawberry, because otherwise, if you preferred strawberry to vanilla, then you prefer strawberry to vanilla, you would then also prefer chocolate to strawberry, but you prefer vanilla to chocolate. So that's called intransitive preferences, and it has at least an apparent relation. What exactly that relation is controversial, has some relation to consistency. Some people think, well, if you don't have transitive preferences, your preferences are akin to being inconsistent. Now, the point, I must have done a bad job in talking about this, is that Mises, if you look at page 103 of Human Action in the edition we're using, does not say that transitive preferences are required for rationality, but some people answered that it was required, which is just the contradictory of what Mises was saying. So please remember, he's not requiring transitive preferences in order to be rational. That's, there are economists who do think that, but Mises isn't one of them. Then the last point I wanted to mention from the quiz, this is the quiz on chapter 6, is what about stability of preferences? You keep the same preferences, say, as you had in the past. You don't change your preferences. So what I wanted there was that that is not required for rationality, but some people went a bit further and thought that it's impossible to have stable preferences. But, you know, when you're trying to answer a question on a test, you always have to ask yourself, does your answer really make sense? Well, look, don't you have some preferences today that you had, say, last week or even last year? You've kept the same preferences. So if you just think of that, then you realize that that couldn't be the right answer, that stability of preferences isn't possible. Okay, so now we want to go on to the chapter 7, and here is a very important chapter, because what Mises is doing in this chapter is he's preparing the way for the rest of the book. What he's done in part 1 generally is give the philosophical background for economic theory. And what he's doing in this chapter, he's actually showing how the philosophy leads into some propositions about economics itself. So he's actually doing more straight economic theory than we found in at least most of what we've been covering so far. And then in the rest of the book, he'll be going right into the economics. And because he's doing that, that's no doubt why for the rest of the series on human action, they've taken me out and they put in economists. I think Joe Salerno, who's an outstanding economist, will be doing the course on part two of human action. But this is the chapter really where they kicked me out. Oh, I see there's, let me just see here, there's a question somebody has here that. Does that they don't believe in temporal subjective value? No, that wouldn't follow. They would just say that this is a person's subjective preferences. Well, they would say that when they're talking about transitive preferences, they're not talking about preferences over a period of time at all. They're talking about preferences that you have at the same time. And Mises doesn't accept that because he takes preferences just to be shown in action, so we can't really speak of all these choices between one good and another unless there's a direct choice in action. So they're rejecting his view that neoclassicals are rejecting his view that you're only showing preference in the immediate action that you're doing, you see. Okay, so as I say, in chapter 7, Mises is going to get into some real economics, and that's why they're kicking me out for the rest of the book. So what happens here? Wait, let me just see if this works. Ah, here we go. Okay, now, we've heard a number of times, probably you're sick of it by now, but that action involves the use of means to achieve an end. Say, I want people to hear what I'm saying, so I'm talking into this microphone. So I'm using this as a means to achieve an end. Now, suppose we have the question, well, there are all sorts of different means we can use to achieve ends that we have. How would we rank them? How would we grade these means? Now, I don't mean by grade, giving letter grades A, B, or C, but I mean, how would we rank them? Which would we think are more valuable than others? Now you might think that you can't do that, say, because actions are all different. Supposing, say, I'm using this microphone to try to speak, to have a louder sound to my voice than I'd have without it. Well, that's a completely different action, say, than if I were planting peas in a garden. So how could you compare, say, what I'm planting with the microphone there? They have completely different ends. So you might think, well, you can't rank or grade all the means that you have because all the actions are different. But Mises said, no, that's not right. Because he said, all actions, regardless of what they are, aim to relieve felt uneasiness. Remember, we were talking about this in previous lecture. It shouldn't be given a kind of a psychological meaning that you're kind of feeling very tense and you're thinking, how can I relieve my uneasiness? Maybe I should take an aspirin or do something else or get some Demerol and I'd relieve my felt uneasiness. No, what Mises means there is that in some way I see a way of improving the situation I'm in, or at least doing something so that the situation I'm in will be better than it otherwise would have been. Can anybody see why I worded it in that awkward way, other than I like that sort of thing? Why I say, instead of just saying you're trying to improve things, why did I say you could be trying to make things better than they otherwise would have been? Does anybody want to try that one? Well, I don't see any immediate takers for that. The thing is, it could be that I think things are getting worse, but I could do something so they'd be better than they would be without doing that thing. So I think, well, I'm going to have to take a pay cut, God forbid. I'm going to have to take a pay cut, but I can do something, so I can do some extra work, so I won't be losing as much money as I would have had otherwise. So things are worse than they are right now, but they're not as bad as they would be if I didn't do something. So that can be a way of relieving uneasiness as well. So again, remember, we're trying to relieve felt uneasiness. So given that that's true of all the actions that we're undertaking, we can rank means by how they help us relieve uneasiness. We'd say, well, this one will really be an improvement. I really care, say, about speaking loudly enough so people won't be complaining about my lectures. They say, I care much more about that than, say, than planting peas in a garden. So then if that's true, I'll rank this microphone, which enables me to speak more loudly, higher than, say, what I'm doing when I'm planting the peas in the garden. And Mises points out, when I'm doing this, when I'm ranking these means, this is just a ranking in my mind. It's a purely intensive, not meaning intensive means something, sometimes people use the term to mean intensive means a lot of stress or concentrate. Here it's just used meaning intention, meaning mental, as opposed to extensive, meaning on the outside. But it's purely intensive, it's just something going on in my mind. There aren't external units of measurement that are attached to it. Now here Mises then makes an extremely important point, and if you want to understand Austrian economics, this is very, very important. This is one, I tend to say everything's important, but this one really is important, so make sure you get this. So we're ranking the means. What means it says it's always a particular quantity of a means that we're ranking. For example, suppose you're choosing between an apple and an orange. You're choosing between that particular apple and that orange, not all the apples and oranges that exist. So you're not saying you like the apple over the orange. You're not saying, in general, apples are better than oranges, or all the apples there are. If you could amass all the apples there are in the world, that some would be better than the sum of all the oranges. You're just choosing between this particular apple and this particular orange. Now that sounds pretty obvious, but it's one that people have made mistakes about it, and as we'll see later in the lecture, it was a failure to appreciate this point that led to a major failing of the classical economics, the economists, especially those in Britain in the 19th century, because they didn't take account of this point that we're always choosing a particular quantity of the means. They got into big trouble, and we'll see later on what the trouble was. I'm not telling you now because this is a good way to preserve suspense. Now you can wonder, how did these classical economists get into trouble by ignoring this point? Now you have to listen to the rest of the lecture to find out. Wasn't that clever of me? Okay, so we can see there could be a case where we're choosing between the total quantity of two or more goods, but it would be very rare. What would that case be, where we actually are choosing the total quantity of two or more goods? Well, I mean, that would be pretty, a fairly easy one. I mean, supposing it's just that's what the choice is, we're confronted, say, we wouldn't have it with all the apples and oranges. Suppose we say we have a choice between everything in box A and everything in box B. So we are actually choosing the total quantity. But the point would be, in that case, we're presented with the total amount of both goods. But in general, we're not. We're just presented with some of that kind of good. Now, that point was fairly easy, at least I hope so, that we're always choosing a particular quantity of a good when we're choosing. But it has further implications, and one is a bit tricky. I don't think it's too tricky, but you do have to be careful about this. The implication is we can't sum up the value, and sometimes people use the word utility for meaning value, of particular amounts of a good. So, supposing, say, let's say, imagine we're picking an apple. We say, well, we're giving this apple a certain ranking. Then we pick another apple. We give that apple another ranking. And we'll see later, the second apple will be ranked lower than the first one. So we have a third apple. We're giving a ranking of that. So suppose the question came up, well, what is the value of apple 1 plus 2 plus 3? Remember, we've given each one a ranking. So we've given the first apple a ranking, second one a ranking, third one a ranking. So what is the rank of all three of them? And this is the tricky part. That isn't deducible from the rankings of the first, second, or third. We can't just sum up the ranking of the, say we gave the first one, say, rank a number 2, and say the second one was number 5, and the third one was number 12. So we can't just sum up these rankings, say the ranking of the whole set is the sum of those rankings. Now, we could, suppose we had to choose 3 apples, say, where do 3 apples rank? We could give that a rank, that would be the 3 apples would be composed of individual apples, but we would be ranking those 3 separately. We wouldn't be summing up the rank from the value of each one. You see, that's a bit tricky, but I hope you get that. And what is the reason for that? Because remember, if you said, well, you could sum up the rankings of these goods, you'd be denying that when you're choosing, you're always choosing a particular quantity, because in the case where you're just summing up, you're not choosing that sum. That would be a different case. You're just adding up the utility of each good, or the value of each good, and you can't do that just because you're always choosing a particular quantity of the good. So unless you're actually choosing these 3 apples, there's no value for the sum. You can't say, well, it's just the sum of what these individual apples are. You're only valuing particular quantities of good. Again, it sounds simple, but you just have to hold on to that statement and follow through with it if you're going to get the rest of these implications. Now, here's an example to illustrate what I said. Suppose I rank 12 oranges over 12 apples. Say, if I had a choice between 12 oranges and 12 apples, I'd take the 12 oranges. Now, the group of 12 oranges is the sum of 12 individual oranges. But it does not follow the utility group, the value, how high you rank this, is the sum of the rank, or it should be rankings, I put rankings. Well, this would be true too. Is not the sum of the rankings of each individual orange. So again, here we're choosing a group of 12 oranges, so we have to ask, where does that rank? And we can't get that by just summing up how we rank each apple and just trying to add them up, because you can't add up values to get a total. You're just valuing, again, particular quantities of a good. Now, I've used the phrase, the word utility, and used this before. And what does this mean? Well, when we're talking about utility, we mean subjective utilities. How does a particular actor rank a good? What is he, how high or low does he think it? Say, if I say the utility of this microphone would mean how it enables me to speak louder. How do I rank that? How important is that to me that the microphone enables me to speak better? Now, people talk about objective utility. And here, this refers to the physical powers a good has to produce certain effects. For example, there's something about a microphone, I have no idea what it is, that enables it to make spoken words sound louder. Something to do with the sound waves and something that happens inside the microphone. So the microphone has the physical power to produce that effect. So another example is, you take aspirin, it has the power to relieve pain. You won't have a headache if you're going to, if you take the pain. Well, I see a couple questions here. Let me just interrupt. Now I see one from Rod, choosing complete the circuit, sort of like opening the box to see if a cat dies. Maybe we could come back to that. I don't understand this one. And here's one, what of a good that has intrinsic quantifiable value like money? Ah, that's an excellent question. You see, again, suppose you said, what is the value to you of $50? Well, that, again, let's just apply the same point. You couldn't get that by saying, well, what is the value to you of $1? What is the value to you of $2? What is the value to you of the third dollar, and so on. You'd have, if you're choosing offered $50, you would take that as a unit and say, where does that rank? You wouldn't get it by summing up the value of each unit. So again, the fact that the number 50 consists of 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1, so on, does not imply that the value of $50 is to be gotten or is equal to the value to you of $1, the value of a second dollar, and so on. So it's quite different. Okay, so as I was saying, we can talk about objective utility, meaning the physical powers a good has to produce certain effects. But when we talk about utility economics, we mean the subjective utility, which is how you rank the good. And people can value a good based on false beliefs about its objective utility. Say you could believe some medicine will cure your disease, but it won't, but you value it anyway. It reminds me of a story, like most things. There was someone at a carnival who was selling a bottle, and he said this would cure all sorts of diseases. And he said, I remember there was a man who couldn't walk without crutches, and he took some of this liquid and he rubbed some on his right leg, and he threw away his right crutch. Then he took some, rubbed it on his left leg, threw away his left crutch. And someone in the audience said, what happened then? And the man said, he fell flat in his face. I told you he couldn't walk without crutches. Well, that one won't be on the quiz. Okay, prolonged laughter, please. Okay, so as I say, people could value a good based on false beliefs about its objective utility, and people could also fail to value a good because they don't know its objective utility. Say, at one time, people didn't realize that oil was extremely valuable. They just said, oh, it's these substance in the ground that's very messy, so they didn't rate it very highly because they didn't know its objective properties. Now, supposing, and this is one of the basic tasks in economics, supposing you're trying to find out how price is determined. One of the basic ideas in economics, we want to find out how prices are determined. So suppose you're trying to find out how much people are willing to pay for something. Now, a natural idea would be to ask how much people value it. When you think, well, if you're trying to find out why certain things have high prices, it would be because people value them a great deal, so they'd be willing to pay a lot of money for them. And it seems pretty obvious you'd be willing to pay more for something that you rank higher than for something you rank lower. Say, if I don't care about speaking loudly, I wouldn't pay very much money for a microphone, but if I I would pay a lot. Of course, even better, I'd get somebody else to spend the money and give it to me, but never mind that. So you would think it's pretty obvious that price depends on how much people value something. But the classical economists of the 19th century weren't able, they were unable to construct a theory of price based on this obvious point about utility. So they couldn't, it seems obvious that price depends on how much people value things, but they couldn't construct a theory of price based on it. Now, I gave a course a while ago on Murray Rothbard's History of Economic Thought, and one point he made was that economists before the 19th century were able to solve this problem, but what we have to understand now, we're not doing history of economics and Mises and talk about it, but the classical economists, the ones in the 19th century, people like David Ricardo, John Stuart Mill in Britain, couldn't construct a theory of price based on utility, even though that seems a very obvious way to go. Now, why couldn't they do it? Why didn't the classical economists arrive at a theory of price based on utility? And the answer is they couldn't solve a paradox. There was a problem for this theory and they couldn't solve it. And the problem is that goods with high utility sometimes have lower prices than it should be goods with low with high than that lower price than goods with low utility, not high utility. Boy, that's the second major error I've made so far. So it's the paradox is goods with high utility sometimes have lower prices than goods with low utility. I think we can make this a little clearer with an example. Mises used the example of gold and iron, but the usual example is given in water and diamond. People talk about the diamond-water paradox. And here's the paradox is, isn't water much more valuable than diamond? Because after all, water is essential for life. If you don't have water, say, for more than a day or so, you're going to die. But diamonds are a luxury. But diamonds cost much more than water. So why is this the problem for the theory that says that the price depends on value? Well, according to the view that price depends on value, goods that people value highly should have a high price, but it seems like, well, we value water higher than nearly everything else, but water is usually available for free or at very low prices. But diamonds are much less essential to life than water. I mean, if you after all could live without diamonds, they're just a luxury, but they cost much more than water. So the classical economists said, well, look, we can't really explain prices by value because then we'll just come up with the wrong results. We would say that waters would have a very high price, but in fact it doesn't. It has a very low price. Now, the solution to this paradox is easy based on what we already learned in the lecture. Remember, the point I've been stressing, talked about a lot, mentioned a number of times, that Mises says is that when we're choosing, we're always choosing specific quantity of a good. So people never choose between all the diamonds in the world and all the water. If you had a choice between water and diamond, it would be a choice between a specific amount of water and a specific amount of diamonds. So you see already that we see there's the paradox isn't so paradoxical, because even though the total sum of all the water in the world is, even though, let me rephrase it, even if water is essential to life and diamonds aren't, we're never choosing between all the water in the world and all the diamonds. We're just choosing in a particular situation, possibly, between water and diamonds. Now, we need, in order to solve a paradox, you can see how the paradox is in trouble, but to get the full solution, we have to understand the law of marginal utility, which is one of the most important laws in Austrian economics. And before we can do that, we have to understand the concept of units, a unit of a good. Now here, a unit, let me say a unit means just like a division of a good, like, so what counts as a unit is also subjective, just like the value of a good is subjective. What counts as a unit of good is also subjective. So, supposing again, say we had 12 apples. So, in many cases, say, you would say the person who's choosing will take each apple as a unit, but he wouldn't have to. He could group apples, say, and take two apples as a unit. It would just depend on what he wanted to use the apples for. So units aren't an objective matter, just how a particular person will classify a good. So for a particular actor, the units of a good have the same qualities as he's regarding them. So let's take the easy case where there are 12 apples and the person regards each apple as a unit. So far as the actor is concerned, each apple has the same qualities. Now, it's likely that physically there'll be slight differences between the apples. One might be, say, slightly larger, have a slightly different color than the other. But if the actor is classifying as units, he's regarding them as all having the same qualities. They're the same to him. So because the actor regards all the units of a good as having the same qualities, they're interchangeable. Say, let's imagine, say, that you have an apple, say, your apples are on a table, and while, say, the one who owns the apples it walks out of the room, and somebody just switches the position of two apples, it wouldn't matter to the person when he comes back, because all the apples are interchangeable. Unless it was very important, unless there were separate qualities to the apple, wouldn't matter which apple is in which position. He takes the units to be interchangeable. So because of that, say, you can always substitute one unit for another. Say if you have, say, one apple you're getting ready to eat, and then another one, say you're going to make apple juice, then somebody takes away the apple you were going to use for apple juice. You could always, if you wanted, use the other apple for apple juice. You can always substitute one for the other, the unit of a good. Okay, now we get to the payoff part. So we're going to get the final step that will enable us to solve this diamond water paradox. How is it, if value determines price, that water, which has a great deal of value, has a lower price than diamonds? So remember again, we said this many, many times, we're always acting to remove felt uneasiness. So we're always acting to remove the greatest uneasiness that we can. We're always trying to pick what will improve our situation the most of any of the choices available to us. Now suppose we have several units of a good. So what will we do? Well, we'll use the first unit to satisfy our highest value want, the second unit to satisfy the next, and so on. So we're going to, for different uses of the good, we can put the units of the good to these different uses. Remember, units are not physically defined, they're just defined by how the actor regards them. So we're going to put the first unit to satisfy our highest value want, and so on. Now how do we know this? Well, it just follows from the point about felt uneasiness. We're going to try to improve our situation in the most that we can, so we're going to select the most urgent want, the one that we value the highest, to satisfy first. That, when you think about it, seems quite obvious, at least. It follows directly from understanding that we always act to remove felt uneasiness. Now, what happens if we lose a unit of good? Somebody say we had 12 apples, we're devoting the apples to different uses. Somebody just takes one away. So what we'll do is we'll give up the use of the good that we value least. It doesn't matter which unit we actually lose. I mean, supposing, say, we have one apple we're getting ready to eat, and that's the most important use of any apple that we have, so somebody just snatches the apple away from us. So then I won't say, well, I'm just going to have to leave all the other apples in whatever uses they were, but I'll just not be able to have an apple to eat. If I valued eating an apple first, I would just take an apple in one of the other uses and transfer it to that use. I just eat one of the remaining apples. So we'll shift the apples around so that we only have to give up the least valued use. And how is it that we're able to do that? Well, remember, from when we talk about the concept of units, that the units of a good are interchangeable. So that's how I can always shift between one use and another. So now we can solve the diamond water paradox. Because how we do this? Well, water is available in abundance. There's a lot of water around. So each unit of water is put to less valued uses. And the last unit of water we put to a use that's worth little or no money. But diamonds are relatively scarce. There aren't that many diamonds. It's hard to mine diamonds and get them out. So the last unit will thus still be worth a lot of money. So what enables us to solve this diamond water paradox is realizing we only choose between specific quantities of a good, and then adding to that a law of marginal utility that as we get more and more of a good, the value of the unit of a good goes down because it's being devoted to less and less valued uses. So because there's a whole lot of water around, not that many diamonds, that explains why diamonds are worth more than water, why they have a higher price than water. And we can still explain prices by value, so we can solve the paradox. Now, according to Mises, this law of marginal utility that says that we're devoting units of good to the highest ranking goal or end that we can, as we add units, the good will have lower and lower value. Now I see Sineda wants a large diamond. All you have to do is get engaged to a rich person, you'll probably get one. That's the best I can do on short notice. Okay, so according to Mises, this law of marginal utility follows directly from the concept of action. So we know it a priori. You remember, what is knowing something a priori means? That our justification for it doesn't depend on experience. So it isn't, say, that we look around and see, well, what happens when people get more and more units of a good? We see, do they in fact value the units less than they did before? It isn't something that we get from experience. We can know it by just thinking it out in our heads. So according to Mises, we know the law of marginal utility to be true a priori. We can just get it by thinking about it. Now, there are various writers, both economists and others, who had empirical arguments in favor of the law. One of these was the great scientist who lived in the 18th century, Daniel Bernoulli. His brother was also a great scientist. So what Bernoulli thought was, he was not concerned with marginal utility in general, but he talked about diminishing marginal utility of money. So supposing, what would be an example is, supposing we ask, what would an extra dollar be worth to Bill Gates? He probably wouldn't rate it very highly because he has so much money already. Probably getting an extra dollar wouldn't be that big deal for him. But so Bernoulli thought he had some way of measuring that, so he could tell you how much utility of money would diminish, and Mises doesn't accept that. So this is kind of an empirical claim. Another one was by a 19th century writer named Heinrich Gossen, whom Werner Zombart referred to as the brilliant idiot. So he had what's called the law of satiation of wants. What did he mean by that? Supposing you're eating ice cream. Say, I like ice cream, that's why I give a lot of examples about that. So suppose I had a scoop of ice cream, I'd be pretty happy about that. But supposing I had 10 scoops of ice cream, then probably I wouldn't get so happy. I'd find I had all the ice cream I wanted, I would just get satiated, I'd be full, so I wouldn't want any more. So Gossen said, well, that's why we know this law of marginal utility is true, because people just will have their satisfaction exhausted if they get enough of a good, just like you can just keep eating, you'll overeat. Or again, supposing you like to, say, watching baseball on TV, well, suppose you just keep watching the game, say, one game after another, say, for 24 hours, you probably get pretty tired of it. But this is true in certain cases, but it's just a psychological generalization about people. It's not something that's known a priori to be true. And sometimes, in fact, if you get more of a certain good, you'll get more satisfied, you'll like it better. Now, Mises would just say, well, then you have to ask, what is the unit the person is choosing? But you see, the base points, remember here, what Gossen is doing is talking about making a claim about people's psychology, and Mises doesn't want to do this that way. He wants to say, no, it's something that's known a priori. And I see a question from Neil here. How would means account for the fact that some rich people cheat for small amounts of money? Ah, you see, that's perfectly consistent with the law of marginal utility, because what the law of marginal utility just says is, maybe the way I explained it, Bill Gates' example wasn't so good. The law of marginal utility says, all that says is that the as you acquire more units of a good, they're going to be put to less valued uses than if you had fewer units of the good. So you get more, you're devoting that to less valued uses. Now, it doesn't follow from that that you don't want the more units, or you don't place high value on them. It's just that you don't place as high value as you would on the previous unit. So I think I'm glad you raised this point. I think I gave a misleading way of saying the Bill Gates. I said, well, maybe probably dollar wouldn't mean that much to Bill Gates. But I should have said it wouldn't mean as much as the dollar would when he didn't have much money. So the answer to your question is, the rich people still value these small amounts of money, but not as much as amounts of money when they didn't have as much. And it could also be they like, another possibility in your case would be just they like cheating people. Just they enjoy cheating, and that's why they're doing it. Now, bother, we can't evaluate somebody else's subjective evaluation. I think what you're saying, if I understand what you're saying, I think that's right. We would just be able to say we can't measure somebody's subjective satisfaction. We could just say that's the way he ranks them. So anyway, we've mentioned Gaussian. On another one, I won't go into details of what's involved, the so-called Weber-Fechner law. And this has to do, it's, again, it's another psychological law having to do with the effects of physical stimulus on people. Say something like, imagine you put your arm in hot water. What would be the effect of increasing the temperature? And there a psychological law on how much you'll feel on increase. It has something to do with logarithms. I won't go into the details about it. But that, again, is a psychological claim about how particular people act. But law of marginal utility, again, is a rational necessity. Now, I now want to go into a different economic law that Mises talks about, different from law of marginal utility, but it's also one that he thinks can be derived a priori. It's one we can know to be true just by thinking about it. Now, suppose you need several goods to make a consumption good. Say you want to have a loaf of bread. You'd need some flour and water, and you need an oven. So you need several goods to make the consumption good. Or you could have higher order goods to make a lower order production good. Say you had a bowl that you're putting the flour in. We could ask, what do you need to make the bowl? So that wouldn't be a consumption good. You'd be using the bowl, say, to make bread, which would be the consumption. We could say it would be you need higher order goods. Say, well, the bowl is a production good you're using to produce something, but you need some other goods to produce that. So, again, we have to have a situation. You need several goods to make something. You need several things to make something. So while return says there's an optimum amount for each of the factors of production, say you need, you're producing something, you need, say, three goods to make this. So there's an optimum amount for each factor. What does that mean? Supposing you hold all the factors constant except one, and then you increase the one that you're not holding constant. So you can then say, as you're increasing this one factor, you're getting an increase in the total product. So you divide the increase in total product by the increase in the factor production. So the law of return says there'll be some increase in the factor production that will maximize what you get when you divide the total product by the increase in the factor. There'll be something that some increase will maximize this division. You'll get the most, it'll be the most proportionally increase in the product by using that amount. According to Mises, this is something we can know a priori, just like law of marginal utility. Now, how do we know this? Well, Mises uses an interesting proof. He says, let's assume we didn't. So it's proof by saying, assuming the opposite and showing that that leads to a contradiction. So supposing there's an optimum amount, so then by increasing one factor of production, we could get as much as we wanted of a product, because we could just keep putting more and more of that factor, and it'd be just keep increasing. So we could reduce the amounts of the other factors even to an infinitesimal amount, as small as possible. We could just compensate for it by increasing this one factor. So then this would contradict the premise that we need several factors of production to get the product, because we said, well, we're starting off, you need, say, three factors to get the production, to get the product. But if you could just get any amount of increase just by increasing one of them, you really wouldn't need the other factors, because you could always get more by increasing this one factor. So that is the proof of the law of returns. Now, the last topic I want to mention is the disutility of labor. And to understand disutility of labor, we have to ask, well, what does Mises mean by labor? It's really a basic concept, is we have energy in our body and physical energy. We can use the physical mental energy to get things that we want. Say again, I want to give a lecture, so I can move my body and mouth in certain ways to do that. Reminds me of one comedian once said that you can learn a lot about what someone is thinking by watching his face, especially the mouth part of the face. Okay, so we're applying our energy to get things we want. Now, in most cases, what we want are goods external to our body. I want to light a fire, so I want to say start a forest fire. You know, I just light a match and start the forest fire. That's something I want external to me. I say, well, why do I want to do it? And I'm following the old motto, forest fires prevent bears. So I want to start a forest fire, so I strike a match and set the trees on fire. So now there are some cases where we want changes that aren't external. Imagine I'm doing exercise. I actually was on the treadmill because I'm an old man. I need to keep up. So I'm trying to get in better shape. So Mises calls this intraversive labor. Somebody says unbearable. That's excellent. Excellent. Now, we could imagine a world in which people labored as much as they physically could. Rob versus extroverts. Yes, I think that's right. Extrovert being outside the person as opposed to introversion, which would be aiming at an internal effect in the person. But I can imagine people laboring as much as they physically could. It wouldn't mean they would have to work till they drop, because that probably wouldn't be good for you, and then you wouldn't be able to work at all. I mean, it would be something like taking account your what you need, the periods of rest you needed. You would be just laboring so you'd have the maximum product. So what Lee says, well, this isn't our world. We don't labor as much as we physically could. We generally find that there's some cost to labor, in the sense we'd rather avoid it if we could. So people value leisure, the absence of labor, even though let's say you're a student and you're studying various subjects, so you're reading your books, your textbooks. So after a while, you might feel you just don't want to study anymore. You want to, say, go out and play or go out with your friends. So even though, let's imagine, you could continue to study if you wanted, it wouldn't be just that you get so tired you wouldn't be able to read anymore. You could if you wanted, but you just don't want to. So people value leisure, which is the absence of labor. Now, this isn't an a priori truth. How do we know it's not an a priori truth? You should be able to get that from this slide. Well, remember, I said we can imagine a world, we can conceive a world in which people labored as much as they physically could. So if it's an a priori truth, then we couldn't imagine, or at least we couldn't conceive of such a world. I'm not going to get into now, it's an interesting question, different between being able to imagine, being able to conceive something. But basically, if it were a priori that people value leisure, then we really couldn't conceive a world in which people labored as much as they physically could, but we can. Now, I see Malcolm raised a point I'm going to raise just now. Some people love their work. There is some labor that's directly gratifying. Mises doesn't deny that, but he's skeptical about how much of this exists. So, in general, remember, this utility of labor, then, is something that just is true in our world, but doesn't have to be. So the parts of praxeology that depend on this utility of labor and anything deduced from that are not known to be true a priori. So it isn't the case that all of praxeology is a priori true. There's part that isn't, and this part isn't. This utility of labor is not an a priori truth. Well, okay, I think we'll now go to the questions, so you can have questions either in the chat or the Q&A, whichever you like, and I'll try to evade them, I mean answer them as best I can. I don't see no question. Well, is everybody satisfied with the election results yesterday? Or well, Sinead isn't. Oh, good. Well, that alone in time is due to a big diamond. Now, Neil says, some people think that Austrianism ended with marginal utility theory. That's an interesting question. Well, I think there are economists who would say, Menger, Karl Menger in the 1870s, was one of those who discovered the subjective theory of value and along with it marginal utility, and they don't take much account of Austrian contributions after that. So I think there are probably people who think that. John says law of marginal utility is the same as law of diminishing margin. Yes, that's right. That's right. Now, Andrew says, do you find mainstream economists adhering to the idea that you can total up the utility of a good and is quantify subjective valuations? There are some who do and some who don't. I mean, there are attempts to measure utility, and those people would presumably say you could total up the utility of a good. But they wouldn't have to, actually. I mean, they could accept the view that you're only choosing a particular quantity. So someone could actually accept the view that you don't get the utility of a particular, say, particular good by summing up the utility of its parts, if it has any. The utility of a good is something that determined just by the amount that's actually chosen. But somebody could say, well, but still you can quantify that amount, so it's a separate issue, you see. Now, here's one from Malcolm. With law of diminishing return, could you chat about that may be related or not related to best use of resource and content to environmental issues? We say that having a regulated market prevents the law of diminishing return being good check and balance on wasteful expenditure of environmental resources. It would certainly be the case that if you have a regulated market, people would interfere with how people in a free market would be using the resources, and the fact that people are getting diminishing returns would certainly figure into their decisions on a free market in determining how to use resources. But I don't think regulations would prevent the law of diminishing returns in particular from operating. It would just change the structure of incentives in which people are making their decisions. Now let's see, there's something going on here that's interesting. Did they really, what did Erica say here? It sounded like they legalized pot. Oh yes, I saw it. I think from what I understand, as Brian said, it's against federal law. So if somebody started smoking pot in those states, the federal authorities could still arrest them. And that happened a bit in California. You know, the pot is legal for use as a medicine, but there have been cases, I think, where the federal authorities have arrested people, even though they weren't in violation of state law. Generally, they haven't, but it's within their legal power to do that. Now here's one from Tim. Do you think Mises would talk about himself when he would talk about genius and following their mission, even while knowingly moving toward their own disaster? Well, I think that's quite possible. The genius, now of course, that's a notion that came in very much in the 19th century. It was very popular. It's somebody, as he explained, kind of driven to do his work. He'll let nothing stop him. It isn't that he gets gratification from it. He could just be in agony, but he must go on with that. I don't know that Mises really felt himself in agony that he just had to create regardless of what was going on, but maybe he did. It's a very interesting question. I think possibly he was one of those cases. Now here's one. I see people are they're enthusiastic about having being able to smoke pot legally. Ah, that's interesting. Well, naturally, it reminds me of one of my stories. There was a man who went into a doctor's office. He had his ears, nose, and mouth all stuffed with cigarettes. The doctor said, can I help you? And he said, sure, got a match? I'd like to give a course just on my jokes, but I don't think very many people would take it. Oh, good. Well, we have some. Now, here's one. What did Frege mean when he said Vienna is no Trieste? That I don't know. It's an interesting question. Now, here's one. John Galt says, how critical is the first part of human action to the rest of the book? Well, I think it's important it's very important that you understand the philosophical background. So Mises is making a lot of claims in the rest of the book about economics. So you want to ask, well, how does he know these claims are true? He doesn't seem to be citing any experiments or empirical studies. Why is he justified making those claims? So you understand the first part of human action, you'll see, explain what is the method of procedure he's using, why is he doing economics in the way he is. So I think that's why he's doing that. Let's see, someone says, they take my course on jokes because they're masochists out there. Well, I mean, all the better. As long as they have enough money to enroll, that's wonderful. Now, Bob says, the mainline economists pretty much accept marginal utility as a given. Yes, I mean, that's pretty standard in economics. They might not, I don't think they would accept your Mises' a priori way of justifying the law, but that is a basic principle in economics. Someone said, did I see the BBC article regarding attempts to transfer rights to dolphins? Will dolphins have to pay taxes? That's interesting. Well, I mean, there have been animal rights advocates around for a long time. I hadn't seen that one about dolphins, but I mean, there are people who do think animals have rights. It was kind of a popular topic at one time in philosophy, I suppose. Murray Rothbard used to say, well, maybe he'd be prepared to think about that when they ask for the rights. Now, John Galt says, has he created a subjective deductive system of analysis of action better understand the world, in your opinion? Well, he's created a deductive system. I mean, it isn't subjective in the sense it's just something that he's going on in his own mind. It's a deductive system about people's subjective preferences, among other things. I think that's right. That's exactly what he's doing. Now, you say they claim they're self-aware. I'm taking that to mean people claim that dolphins are self-aware rather than the dolphins are claiming that they themselves are self-aware. Good. Well, I mean, animal consciousness is a very interesting topic. John says they just learn the language. Dolphins can't smoke pot, at least if they don't want to be in violation of federal law. I don't know if it's true that Descartes thought animals didn't feel pain. Yes, that is one of his views. He thought that his basic argument was pain is a subjective sensation, but he thought there wasn't justification, if we're trying to understand animal behavior, for going beyond explaining animals just in terms, say, of things going on in their body. Say we're looking at the structure of the animal's brains or its muscular system. He thought that's all there is to animals. So he didn't think, he thought human beings and immaterial spirits such as angels and God have consciousness, but animals really don't have a subjective consciousness, so they wouldn't feel pain. And Neil says he read contradictory things. I mean, I think there are people who say, well, these stories about the Descartes kicking dogs aren't true. But I think it is, it would fit in with at least some things that he says, that animals don't feel pain. Somebody says, John says, again, why is this utility of labor not a priori? Well, remember, this utility of labor, again, is that you're not laboring. Suppose you said, what would be the situation? Say you just wanted to work as much as you possibly could. I don't mean something like, well, you just work till you drop, but you kind of space things out. You say you need a certain time for rest, because otherwise you won't be able to labor so much, or you need to have eat, or so you figure out what are the physical requirements so that you can maximize your labor. You just arrange your schedule. So you couldn't really get out any more labor. You're maximizing over a period of time the labor you got out. So isn't it conceivable that that could be the situation? What if everybody was like that? People just wanted to maximize their labor. So if we can conceive of that situation, then how do we know that's not what's really the case with us? Well, we just say, well, look, I'm not like that, or you're not like that. We just have to find that out from experience. If we have to find something out from experience, it's not a priori. Neil says, how would you respond to the leftist thing that people work hard to make money when taxes are high? Well, you see, it could be that there are some people who do that, but then the point would be, if you have high taxes, then those people would be sacrificing leisure to making money, so it's still interfering with what their preferences. So it could be that high taxes won't, in certain cases, won't decrease revenue. See, the argument against high taxes, well, why would you work if, say, a lot of what you make, or almost all of what you make, is going to the government? Then the counter to that is maybe you would, because you want to maintain a certain standard of living, or you want to make a certain amount of money, so you'll work harder. But if you do that, that's still interfering with a person's preferred ranking of leisure and labor. You could give another example. I mean, suppose somebody's married and then they're divorced and say they have to pay some of their money to their husband or wife they would otherwise, when they were married, they were just regarded as shared between the two of them. So the person who has to pay that might say, well, I'm not going to work extra because then the money will just, part of the money is just going to be going to my wife or husband. So the person would also say, well, I don't want to maintain my standard of living, so I'm going to have to work extra harder. Now, Andrew said, did I make a lecture in the recent 30 years conference? Yes, I did. I spoke on Murray Rothbard and revisionism. I think they're eventually going to post the lectures from the conference. They've posted some of them. It was just a brief talk, about 20 minutes. Now, Hans Hoppeball, I think he should be coming. I think we're both supposed to be at the Mises University for this summer. Zaneda says, when I come from, you only work to survive. And when you have to pay huge taxes, people only work to satisfy their basic needs. Yeah, so that's a lot of people are like that. I mean, why would you work extra hard if it's all going to go to the government? I mean, that's actually many people. That is a very good argument against high taxes, that they won't have the effect. It's just, you could have cases where people just said, well, I'm going to work extra hard just to try to make more money. John says, tax rate problem destroys structure of production and power. The criminal state. Yes, I'm afraid that's what we're very frequently are doing these days. Well, I do have, for those of you who are thinking of taking any my courses in future, I do have one item of good news for you. As you know, you've taken my course and you're in this course, you see my PowerPoint slides are very dull. You just have things written on them. But there's a friend of mine who's going to be helping me, who's going to put in images and all sorts of other things on my future slides. So if you take any more of my courses, the slides will be, I hope, a little more interesting. Oh, someone likes it. Yes, we'll keep all the text, but we're just going to try to jazz it up a little bit. The person I asked does very good slides. So oh, somebody, they like my slides. Well, this friend of mine, hers are better, so I think you'll like hers. John says, I thought economics was narrative. Well, that's another story. Extended dance remix. Yes. Why not, as long as you're in step? Oh, I have a very good audience. People laugh at some of my jokes. That's good. Oh, Bob says, you really cleared up the first chapter of human action. Oh, thank you. I'm glad you feel that way. I enjoy going through the chapters in so much detail. You know, I've very often given lectures on praxeology. I hadn't before, and some I've given courses on me. I gave a course on Mises epistemology, but I haven't gone into these particular chapters in as much detail. So I always think when you go through Mises, there's always more in than you realize. And now it says keep the extension. Oh yeah, I guess we're not leaving out any, we still have the text, it's just that this friend of mine is just going to add pictures and other things as she thinks best. I've seen slides from her presentations, they're very good. And Neil says, why did you said he had a professor who didn't update his joke? Well, they referred to the injured warrior. Because I think that was a story Hillel Steiner told me, that there was a professor, say, who was would be talking, I think, in the 1960s. And you have jokes about Sir Stafford Cripps, who was a minister, who was a minister in World War II and had been around in the 1930s. Jonathan Mises is brilliant. It's a shame what he had to endure his life from other so-called economists. Yes, I mean, he was regarded, he was one of the greatest thinkers, but people didn't treat him very well. Now, John says, how did he learn English? Well, Mises was able to read books in English quite early on. You know, he was very good at languages, and I think he learned how to read. And I think he just acquired speaking skills when he moved to the U.S. Now, Kendrick says, would you recommend philosophy econ grad school for future in this field? Well, as what would be the field? More economics. I guess if you're going to economics, you want to go to economics grad school, but if you like philosophy, that would be the one to do. Now, there are programs that study philosophy and economics. Andrew said, did Mises ever have formal debates? So are any of them recorded? I think he did. He had a debate, I think, in Berlin with Werner Zombart, who was one of the leading socialists. But I don't think any of his debates have been recorded. I see Kendrick says to get a job in philosophy, learn this phrase, one prize with that. That's very good. Yeah, so you know what happens if you're eating McDonald's and there's an earthquake. And the answer is fallen arches. Neil says, did Mises have an interaction with Vogelin? Yes, Vogelin was attended his seminar, you know, the private, he was in the Mises seminar. I used to talk, Vogelin knew Mises quite well, and they maintained they knew each other when they're both living in America. Again, says, how is he able to write such English prose in Human Action? Well, he had help from Hazlitt and also Leonard Reed, also from Arthur Goddard, but I think he was very good at acquiring language. See, I think he had a very, if you look at his German, especially in the later books, he tended to have a rather simple style, and he was able to carry this out in English as well. He has a very direct style. It's a bit like, if you look at Carl Schmitt, was another one who wrote that way, which is a rather short sentences. And so you can see sometimes in Mises' writing some examples of where he's maintaining a foreign usage. Instead of saying, he'll say, I remember one sentence, we know or assume to know, instead of saying we know or assume that we know. So occasionally he'll use a certain phrase. John said the German version of Human Action give more knowledge in English. No, I think the English version is the more longer one and more the definitive one. There are a few topics, I think, in that aren't in the distinguish one. Like, he discusses certain German thinkers a little bit more. And he has actually has an interesting section on Hitler's Mein Kampf that isn't in the other one. Well, with short films on these younger, certainly didn't seem. No, it was not. It was definitely not. There were only a few people who wrote in fairly short phrases. It was very unusual. Long sentences were very characteristic. German, I mean, Mark Twain had some jokes about how you have to wait till the end of the sentence to find the subject of the sentence. Well, okay, I guess I want to thank all of you for coming to my course, and this is the last lecture, so I hope to see you in future courses. And I have one more quiz for you, and thanks again for coming to my course, and I appreciate it very much. I hope to see you again soon. Bye, everybody.